Chapter 26. The public. Sometimes it is a gentleman, with a physique admirable, de talents dissociate and a place under government, who makes a sacrifice of himself in a similar manner. In our little historical gallery we find this philanthropic anti-Malthusian at the head of an establishment of this kind, introducing a very meek, simple-looking bachelor to some distinguished ladies of his cognizance. Let me present you, sir, to Madame de Saint-Bertrand. It is our old friend, Veuve de la Grande Armée, aimed Lieloa de Wormspire. Ses dames brûlant de l'envy de faire votre cognizance. Je laissez I invitees a diner chez vous ce soir. Vous nous mèneres à l'opéra, et nous ferons une petite partie d'écart. Tenez vous bien, M. Gobbard. Ses dames ont des projets sur vous. Happy Gobbard. Happy system, which can thus bring the pure and loving together, and acts as the best ally of hymen. The announcement of the rank and titles of Madame de Saint-Bertrand Veuve de la Grande Armée is very happy. A Grande Armée has been a father to more orphans, and a husband to more widows, than it ever made. Mistresses of cafes, old governesses, keepers of boarding houses, genteel beggars, and ladies of lower rank still, have this favorite pedigree. They have all had malheurs. What kind it is needless to particularize, they are all connected with the Grande Armée, and their fathers were all colonels. This title exactly answers to the clergyman's daughter in England as, a young lady, the daughter of a clergyman, is desirous to teach, and see a clergyman's widow receives into her house a few select, and so forth. Appeal to the benevolent. By a series of unheard-of calamities, a young lady, daughter of a clergyman in the west of England, has been plunged, and see. The difference is curious, as indicating the standard of respectability. The male beggar of fashion is not so well known among us as in Paris, where street doors are open, six or eight families live in a house, and the gentleman who earns his livelihood by this profession can make half a dozen visits without the trouble of knocking from house to house, and the pain of being observed by the whole street, while the footman is examining him from the area. Some few may be seen in England about the inns of court, where the locality is favorable, where, however, the owners of the chambers are not proverbially soft of heart, so that the harvest must be poor, but Paris is full of such adventurers, fat, smooth-tongued, and well-dressed, with gloves and gilt-headed canes, who would be insulted almost by the offer of silver, and expect your gold as their right. Among these, of course, our friend Robert plays his part, and an excellent engraving represents him, snuffbox in hand, advancing to an old gentleman, whom, by his poodle, his powdered head, and his driveling, stupid look, one knows to be a Carlist of the old regime. Beg pardon, says Robert, is it really yourself to whom I have the honor of speaking? Tis. Oh, you take snuff? Thank you. I have had misfortunes, I want assistance. I am a Vendian of illustrious birth. You know the family of MacCarbic we are of Brest. My grandfather served the king in his galleys. My father and I belong, also, to the marine. Unfortunate suits at law have plunged us into difficulties, and I do not hesitate to ask you for the succor of 10 francs. I never give to those I don't know. Aight, sir. Perfectly right. Perhaps you will have the kindness to lend me 10 francs? The adventures of Dr. Macaire need not be described, because the different degrees in quackery which are taken by that learned physician are all well known in England, where we have the advantage of many higher degrees in the science, which our neighbors know nothing about. We have not Hahnemann, but we have his disciples. We have not Broussais, but we have the College of Health, and surely a dose of Morrison's pills is a sublimer discovery than a draught of hot water. We had St. John Long, to where is his science? And we are credibly informed that some important cures have been effected by the inspired dignitaries of the church in Newman Street, which, if it continue to practice, will sadly interfere with the profits of the regular physicians, and where the miracles of the above Paris are about to be acted over again. And speaking of M. Macaire and his adventures, we have managed so entirely to convince ourselves of the reality of the personage that we have quite forgotten to speak of Messrs. Philippin and Daumier, who are, the one the inventor, the other the designer, of the Macaire Picture Gallery. As works of esprit, these drawings are not more remarkable than they are as works of art, and we never recollect to have seen a series of sketches possessing more extraordinary cleverness and variety. The countenance and figure of Macaire, and the dear stupid Bertrand are preserved, of course, with great fidelity throughout. But the admirable way in which each fresh character is conceived, the grotesque appropriateness of Robert's every successive attitude and gesticulation, and the variety of Bertrand's postures of invariable repose, the exquisite fitness of all the other characters, who act their little part, and disappear from the scene, cannot be described on paper, or too highly lauded. The figures are very carelessly drawn. But, if the reader can understand us, all the attitudes and limbs are perfectly conceived, and wonderfully natural and various. After pondering over these drawings for some hours, as we have been while compiling this notice of them, we have grown to believe that the personages are real, and the scenes remain imprinted on the brain, as if we had absolutely been present at their acting. Perhaps the clever way in which the plates are colored, and the excellent effect which is put into each, may add to this illusion. Now, in looking, for instance, at H.B.'s slim vapory figures, they have struck us as excellent likenesses of men and women, but no more. The bodies want spirit, action, and individuality. George Cruikshank, as a humorist, has quite as much genius, but he does not know the art of effect so well as Monsieur Daumier, and, if we might venture to give a word of advice to another humorous designer, whose works are extensively circulated, the illustrator of Ickwick and Achola's Nickleby, it would be to study well these caricatures of Monsieur Daumier, who, though he executes very carelessly, knows very well what he would express, indicates perfectly the attitude and identity of his figure, and is quite aware, beforehand, of the effect which he intends to produce. The one we should fancy to be a practiced artist, taking his ease, the other, a young one, somewhat bewildered. A very clever one, however, who, if he would think more, and exaggerate less, would add not a little to his reputation. Having pursued, all through these remarks, the comparison between English art and French art, English and French humor, manners, and morals, perhaps we should endeavor, also, to write an analytical essay on English cant or humbug, as distinguished from French. It might be shown that the latter was more picturesque and startling, the former more substantial and positive. It has none of the poetic flights of the French genius, but advances steadily, and gains more ground in the end than its sprightlier compeer. But such a discussion would carry us through the whole range of French and English history, and the reader has probably read quite enough of the subject in this and the foregoing pages. We shall, therefore, say no more of French and English caricatures generally, or of Mr. Macaire's particular accomplishments and adventures. They are far better understood by examining the original pictures, by which Philippin and Daumier have illustrated them, than by translations first into print and afterwards into English. They form a very curious and instructive commentary upon the present state of society in Paris, and 100 years hence, when the whole of this struggling, noisy, busy, merry race shall have exchanged their pleasures or occupations for a quiet coffin and a tawdry lying epitaph, a Montmartre, or Pere Lachaise, when the follies here recorded shall have been superseded by new ones, and the fools now so active shall have given up the inheritance of the world to their children. The latter will, at least, have the advantage of knowing, intimately and exactly, the manners of life, and being of their grandsires, and calling up, when they so choose it, our ghosts from the grave, to live, love, quarrel, swindle, suffer, and struggle on blindly as of yore. And when the amused speculator shall have laughed sufficiently at the immensity of our follies, and the paltriness of our aims, smiled at our exploded superstitions, wondered how this man should be considered great, who is now clean forgotten, as Copius Guthrie before mentioned, how this should have been thought a patriot who is but a knave spouting commonplace, or how that should have been dubbed a philosopher who is but a dull fool, blinking solemn, and pretending to see in the dark, when he shall have examined all these at his leisure, smiling in a pleasant contempt and good-humored superiority, and thanking heaven for his increased lights, he will shut the book, and be a fool as his fathers were before him. It runs in the blood. Well hast thou said, O ragged Macair, each hour va passer, mace less bad odds northeast passer and pause. Little points in it. About the year 1760 there lived, at Paris, a little fellow, who was the darling of all the wags of his acquaintance. Nature seemed, in the formation of this little man, to have amused herself, by giving loose to half a hundred of her most comical caprices. He had some wit and drollery of his own, which sometimes rendered his sallies very amusing, but, where his friends laughed with him once, they laughed at him a thousand times, for he had a fund of absurdity in himself that was more pleasant than all the wit in the world. He was as proud as a peacock, as wicked as an ape, and as silly as a goose. He did not possess one single grain of common sense, but, in revenge, his pretensions were enormous, his ignorance vast, and his credulity more extensive still. From his youth upwards, he had read nothing but the new novels, and the verses in the almanacs, which helped him not a little in making, what he called, poetry of his own. For, of course, our little hero was a poet. All the common usages of life, all the ways of the world, and all the customs of society, seemed to be quite unknown to him. Add to these good qualities, a magnificent conceit, a cowardice inconceivable, and a face so irresistibly comic, that everyone who first beheld it was compelled to burst out a laughing, and you will have some notion of this strange little gentleman. He was very proud of his voice, and uttered all his sentences in the richest tragic tone. He was little better than a dwarf, but he elevated his eyebrows, held up his neck, walked on the tips of his toes, and gave himself the airs of a giant. He had a little pair of bandy legs, which seemed much too short to support anything like a human body, but, by the help of these crooked supporters, he thought he could dance like a grace, and, indeed, fancied all the graces possible were to be found in his person. His goggle eyes were always rolling about wildly, as if in correspondence with the disorder of his little brain, and his countenance thus wore an expression of perpetual wonder. With such happy natural gifts, he not only fell into all traps that were laid for him, but seemed almost to go out of his way to seek them, although, to be sure, his friends did not give him much trouble in that search, for they prepared hoaxes for him incessantly. One day the wags introduced him to a company of ladies, who, though not countesses and princesses exactly, took, nevertheless, those titles upon themselves for the nonce, and were all, for the same reason, violently smitten with Master Poinsett's person. One of them, the lady of the house, was especially tender, and, seating him by her side at supper, so plied him with smiles, ogles, and champagne, that our little hero grew crazed with ecstasy, and wild with love. In the midst of his happiness, a cruel knock was heard below, accompanied by quick loud talking, swearing, and shuffling of feet. You would have thought a regiment was at the door. H heavens! Cried the Marchioness, starting up, and giving to the hand of Poinsett one parting squeeze. Fly, fly, my Poinsett! 'Tis the colonel, my husband! At this, each gentleman of the party rose, and, drawing his rapier, vowed to cut his way through the colonel and all his mousquetaires, or die, if need be, by the side of Poinsett. The little fellow was obliged to lug out his sword too, and went shuddering downstairs, heartily repenting of his passion for marchionesses. When the party arrived in the street, they found, sure enough, a dreadful company of mouse-squitters, as they seemed, ready to oppose their passage. Swords crossed, torches blazed, and, with the most dreadful shouts and imprecations, the contending parties rushed upon one another, the friends of Poinsett surrounding and supporting that little warrior, as the French knights did King Francis at Pavia, otherwise the poor fellow certainly would have fallen down in the gutter from fright. But the combat was suddenly interrupted, for the neighbors, who knew nothing of the trick going on, and thought the brawl was real, had been screaming with all their might for the police, who began about this time to arrive. Directly they appeared, friends and enemies of Poinsett at once took to their heels, and, in this part of the transaction, at least, our hero himself showed that he was equal to the longest-legged grenadier that ever ran away. When, at last, those little bandy legs of his had borne him safely to his lodgings, all Poinsett's friends crowded round him, to congratulate him on his escape and his valor. "Egad, how he pinked that great red-haired fellow," said one. "No, did I?" said Poinsett. "Did you? Saw. Don't try to play the modest and humbug US, you know you did. I suppose you will say, next, that you were not for 3 minutes point to point with Cartentius himself, the most dreadful swordsman of the army. Why, you see," says Poinsett, quite delighted, "it was so dark that I did not know with whom I was engaged, although, corbleu, I did for one or two of the fellows." And after a little more of such conversation, during which he was fully persuaded that he had done for a dozen of the enemy at least, Poinsett went to bed, his little person trembling with fright and pleasure, and he fell asleep, and dreamed of rescuing ladies, and destroying monsters, like a second Amadis de Gaulle. When he awoke in the morning, he found a party of his friends in his room. One was examining his coat and waistcoat, another was casting many curious glances at his inexpressibles. "Look here," said this gentleman, holding up the garment to the light, "one, two, three gashes. I am hanged if the cowards did not aim at Poinsett's legs. There are 4 holes in the sword arm of his coat, and 7 have gone right through coat and waistcoat. Good heaven! Poinsett, have you had a surgeon to your wounds?" "Wounds?" said the little man, springing up. "I don't know that is. I hope that is. Oh Lord! Oh Lord! I hope I'm not wounded." And, after a proper examination, he discovered he was not. "Thank heaven! Thank heaven!" said one of the wags, who, indeed, during the slumbers of Poinsett had been occupied in making these very holes through the garments of that individual. "If you have escaped, it is by a miracle. Alas! Alas! All your enemies have not been so lucky." "How, is anybody wounded?" said Poinsett. "My dearest friend, prepare yourself. That unhappy man who came to revenge his menaced honor, that gallant officer, that injured husband, Colonel Count de Cartentius, well, is no more. He died this morning, pierced through with 19 wounds from your hand, and calling upon his country to revenge his murder." When this awful sentence was pronounced, all the auditory gave a pathetic and simultaneous sob, and as for Poinsett, he sank back on his bed with a howl of terror, which would have melted a Visigoth to tears, or to laughter. As soon as his terror and remorse had, in some degree, subsided, his comrades spoke to him of the necessity of making his escape, and, huddling on his clothes, and bidding them all a tender adieu, he set off, incontinently, without his breakfast, for England, America, or Russia, not knowing exactly which. One of his companions agreed to accompany him on a part of this Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.